biochemistry. And the whole world really has changed since then. So I now have spent a good part of the last 25 years actually working on developing assays and applications for biomolecules to be able to do good quality analytical characterization of those molecules and understand and help, you know, understand the biology around what these tools are telling us, the data that's coming out. So I now work for a company called NanoString Technologies, and NanoString is a platform that's actually not dependent on PCR. So we can actually do 800 targets, 800 RNA molecules, for example, in a single reaction with four pipetting steps and optically resolve individual molecules in solution without PCR, directly digitally count these molecules. And so what we're now coming to the point where we also have an FDA-approved clinical diagnostic test for characterization of breast cancer, early-stage breast cancer. And it's now we're now empowered to have clinicians. We're close to having what's called a sample-to-answer platform, and that is where you can grind up a tissue, pipette it into a tube, put it on an instrument, press the button, and get a report out. We're actually now getting to that point where we can analyze biomolecules in what's called a sample-to-answer format. My husband actually works for a company called Integenix, where they take a cheek swab of cell, buccal cells, put it into the instrument, press the button, and get a human ID profile out. And the FBI uses this to identify criminals. So that's also a sample-to-answer platform. So this is really going to be your future in terms of working with biotechnology and having biotechnology inform clinical practice. So with that said, I'd like to talk to you about my very first clinical diagnostic project after graduating from UCSF. So this project was initiated almost 20 years ago. However, it's still the standard of care for HIV genotyping. It is a FDA-approved gold standard test for genotyping and looking at drug resistance of HIV in patients. So this test, even though it was initiated 20 years ago, is still a very relevant and practical test for use in clinical practice. And so HIV, of course, is a virus, but drug resistance is a huge problem. As you know, many of you are probably familiar with bacterial drug resistance. And so antibiotics revolutionized healthcare as well as sanitation. I think sanitation doesn't get enough credit, but developing a good sanitation system about 150 years ago really helped people stay healthy. Antibiotics also do, but as you know, the problem is that they're badly overprescribed, and that's a whole subject in and of itself. I mean, that could be a course on the consequences of bacterial drug resistance. And so we're actually now what they call moving into this, you know, post-antibiotic era, where we really are in danger of losing efficacy of many of our antibiotics, our frontline antibiotics. And so HIV has the same properties. So actually, viruses and bacteria and cancer cells as well can evolve in the presence of these therapeutic agents and evade the activity of the therapeutic agent. So the test that we developed at Applied Biosystems was really meant to characterize the drug resistance profile of HIV and the drug targets for HIV. So that's really what the seminar is about. But it's really positioned in a much bigger context of thinking about how drug resistance affects patients, and we need molecular tools to assess people's drug resistance profiles, not just for HIV, but for other organisms as well as cancer as well. And so that's what the genomic tools are being used for clinically. So in terms of, as I mentioned before, there are other clinically relevant organisms beyond HIV that have many that have drug resistance issues, clinically significant issues. So the major antibiotic resistant strains, so MRSA, as you've heard of, and there are some diagnostic tests now coming out, point-of-care diagnostic tests for analyzing people's bacteria. The current standard, clinical standard, is doing culture methods, and that can take weeks to get results. In fact, I had an infection about 8 years ago in my foot that required a culturing because it wasn't responding to antibiotics, and it took 3 weeks to determine that the bacteria was resistant. That's just not going to cut it, especially for life-threatening situations. Vancomycin resistance is a huge problem as well. So a lot of these really powerful antibiotics, there's drug-resistant strains of bacteria circulating, especially in hospitals. You don't want to go to the hospital if you don't have to because of drug resistance. Because so many antibiotics are being used there, that the bacteria can evolve in the presence of them and become resistant, multi-drug resistant. So extensively drug-resistant tuberculosis is a huge public health problem as well. So this strain of tuberculosis is resistant to pretty much all of the drugs. In terms of other viruses that are antiviral resistance, Tamiflu influenza can become resistant to a frontline medication called Tamiflu. And again, once you're resistant, the drug doesn't work for you. Your virus can replicate in the presence of that drug. And lastly, I'm going to spend the rest of the lecture talking about HIV and how did we develop a molecular test and what is that molecular test for antiretroviral drug resistance for HIV. So just a very brief overview of HIV/AIDS. For those of you, I'm sure you're all very familiar with this disease, but it's called the acquired immune deficiency syndrome. It's essentially a disease of the immune system where immune cells become infected with HIV virus, and so the immune system gets impaired by this infection. And so people become more susceptible to opportunistic infections such as TB or pneumonia when they're infected with HIV because their immune cells are infected and the immune system can't work properly. So as you know, and in fact I was a young scientist, my first technical position after undergraduate was at the Harvard AIDS Institute. And so I actually spent about 5 years working in AIDS biology and then vaccine development prior to coming to UCSF. And that was fascinating because HIV is an incredibly complicated virus and we're still really struggling. We don't have a widely available HIV vaccine 25 years later. So that just tells you about the complexity and the sophistication of this virus. So basically, HIV virus is transmitted through direct contact with body fluids. And the virus infects what are called the CD4 plus lymphocytes, dendritic cells, macrophages. And then that infection spreads throughout the body into other compartments. So how do we deal with HIV infection? Again, I'm not a clinician, but I've hung around enough clinicians that are actually practicing HIV medicine. And understand the therapeutic approach. It's called highly active antiretroviral treatment, or HART. And the basic philosophy of HART is to hit multiple targets at the same time, multiple protein targets with multiple therapeutic classes of drugs. And what that does is it effectively stops the virus in its tracks. So by targeting multiple different proteins, you want to suppress replication. You want to stop replication. Because replication is where viral sequence diversity comes in, and basically, you know, but by stopping replication, you stop the virus evolving. So the goal is to stop the virus evolving, and there's these protocols, and the first protocols were being tested about 20, 25 years ago using these reverse transcriptase and protease inhibitors of HIV. So the goal is to keep the virus titer as low as possible. So in terms of the virion and the biology of HIV, this is what a virion looks like. There's this little compartment in here where the nucleic acid, so this is an RNA virus. It has two copies of RNA. And because it's an RNA virus, it needs to use an enzyme called reverse transcriptase. And reverse transcriptase is actually, any of you who have worked with RNA in the lab, you're familiar with reverse transcriptase. You take RNA and reverse transcribe it into DNA, and then you can amplify that DNA up and do PCR on it and count the copies. We have two copies of RNA. Also, in terms of the surface proteins, these GP120 interacts with the immune system. And I actually worked on a project to characterize GP120. This is this outer glycoprotein. And we identified some highly important regions of HIV GP120 that were interacting with the immune system. And after 2 years, this is part of what inspired me to go to graduate school. After 2 years of negative results in the lab, this multi-million dollar project vaccine, HIV vaccine project with Merck, was canceled because we found out that you change one amino acid on this neutralizing domain in GP120 and you shut down or abolish the neutralizing activity of that antibody. So that it was combinatorially impossible. This was a 30 nucleotide region called the V3 region of HIV. And you change one of those amino acids and it abolishes the neutralizing activity of any antibody. So you think about all the combinations you have to effectively neutralize the virus. It's a very smart virus, very tricky. So it knows how to evade the immune system. And that constant evolution is what drives sequence heterogeneity. So you want to shut down viral replication is the goal. And so this is what HIV looks like budding from a lymphocyte. So these are the little virions coming out of the virus, or of the cell. And so T lymphocytes, CD4 positive lymphocytes, are the sentries for the immune system. So they basically go in and, you know, say, hey, there's something going on, there's an infection. They activate the killer cells and they go in and target viruses or infected cells. So if the CD4 plus lymphocytes are taken out by HIV, they can't send the message out to the immune system that says, hey, there's a problem, there's some infection, you need to go get and kill those infected cells. So that's how HIV is so, one of the reasons why it's so deadly. Sure. Yeah, it's just the little blurbs, the little, yeah, it's a little tiny, this is a high, very high resolution picture of a lymphocyte. So in terms of the biology and the genomic organization of HIV, it's a what's called a retrovirus, meaning that it needs to reverse transcribe using an enzyme. So reverse transcriptase is an enzyme that we don't have as humans. We don't have it. Mammals don't have it, which is why it makes a great drug target. So fortunately, HIV has this reverse transcriptase enzyme that we can target therapeutically. It also has a protease, which is called an aspartyl protease, which is also not a type of protease class that we have. So that also makes it a great drug target. So that's, again, a general rule. If you have some sort of an enzyme or something that can be targeted that's not specific to the organism like yourself, that means you can target with therapeutics, and the chances are you're not going to have off-target activities. You know, again, that's another issue, but reverse transcriptase can be targeted in multiple ways. So basically the RNA virus needs to reverse transcribe itself into DNA, and then it integrates, and there's an enzyme called integrase that integrates the provirus into the human genome. And so once it's been integrated, it's there forever in the cell. So it's part of this retrovirus family in this lentivirus group. So there's other types of retroviruses as well. So in terms of the genome organization, the genome, it's about 10 kb, two copies. And they're actually transcribed in three separate reading frames. So there's a lot of information that's packed into the small genome. And so the major drug target for HIV, in fact, the drug target that the original drugs for HIV were targeting both the Pol gene. Reverse transcriptase was the first protein to be targeted by, and it was interesting, is my dad's a professor, a retired professor at Minnesota, and one of his colleagues had been working on obscure mechanisms for these reverse transcriptases and trying all these analogs to try to block the activity of reverse transcriptase, just out of curiosity, scientific curiosity. It turns out that now he, $300 million later, was able to license these obscure inhibitors because they targeted reverse transcriptase, and we found a very clinically important application, which is HIV and treatment of HIV. So that really shows you the power of funding basic research, having people do these curiosity and discoveries. You never know where they're going to be useful. So, again, that's a really neat story, but these reverse transcriptase inhibitors were available, and we were able to get access to them and start using them clinically. So in terms of the targets for the HIV drug resistance assay, the Pol gene is where this assay is targeted genomically. So what we do is we actually amplify and sequence the 5' end of the Pol gene in the VirusSeq assay, and that's the clinical assay. So this is what the genome looks like, the HIV genome looks like. So, again, it's a lot of proteins packed into a small genomic space. This is translated in three reading frames. So the primary target of interest is the Pol gene. It's actually now branching out a little bit into some other areas. But this is the original, and this is the part of the genome that the VirusSeq assay targets. And so these are the drug targets for HIV. So as I said originally, reverse transcriptase is the original sort of number one target that we looked for therapeutic intervention. Also, protease then came along, because protease is an aspartyl protease, not something that the human species has. And so it can be targeted specifically. And some of the early work and pioneering work on the structure of protease was done at UCSF. And so some of this crystal structure, determination of crystal structure was really important to being able to do. This is one of the success stories in terms of mechanism-based drug design, rational drug design, as it's called. And that's what UCSF is actually known for. So being able to look at a protein structure and understand and model small molecules inhibitors rationally, very powerful aspect of drug discovery. Integrase, so there's, again, protease inhibitors, which are rationally designed, reverse transcriptase inhibitors, which some of which were kind of discovered, you know, for a whole different reason, just looking at the enzyme itself. There's multiple types of reverse transcriptase inhibitors, and I'll talk about that in a minute. Integrase inhibitors is a relatively new, not super new now, but when the assay was originally being developed 20 years ago, we didn't have integrase inhibitors. They were just being talked about. So integrase is actually at the 3' end of this Pol gene. And so that's a new area. It's not yet been incorporated into the VirusSeq assay. And again, when you have an assay that's clinically approved or FDA approved, it takes time to revise it and get it resubmitted to the FDA. It also costs a lot of money. So in fact, Applied Biosystems, as you know, no longer exists. It's now been bought and merged with several other big companies, and it's now part of Thermo Fisher. This assay actually was rolled over from Applied Biosystems to Celera Diagnostics in the late 90s, early 2000s, and Celera put it through the FDA approval process. That took 5 years. So just, in fact, my company just developed an FDA-approved breast cancer prognostic gene expression signature, and it took 3 years. So it can take years to get these tests approved and lots of money and resources. So it's a high bar. You know, you have to get something through the FDA, it's expensive, time-consuming, and labor-intensive. So this is a nice schematic. I just added this slide this year just because I really liked it. It gives you a kind of a snapshot of what these different inhibitors do on a pictorial form. So there's basically four major classes of inhibitors now, HIV drugs. So the reverse transcriptase inhibitor block RNA from being reverse transcribed into DNA. Integrase inhibitors block the activity of integrase to integrate the proviral DNA into the genome of the cell. Protease inhibitors block the processing of the polypeptide. So again, this virus is translated into a polypeptide and then it's processed into individual enzymes. Fusion inhibitors block the fusion of this GP120 protein on the surface of the virus from being able to bind to cellular receptors, and that prevents the virus from being basically engulfed in infecting the cell. So in terms of the HIV drug targets, I want to talk first about the reverse transcriptase inhibitors. So there are two sort of major classes. There's the active site mechanism-based inhibitors, and those were what were discovered, you know, 25 years ago, 30 years ago now. Those are nucleotide analogs that go in and basically block the polymerase activity of reverse transcriptase. They go and interact with the active site and bind to the active site of RT. The non-nucleoside inhibitors bind to what's called the hydrophobic pocket of the enzyme. And I'm going to show you some pictures of the enzymes so that you can get a feel for physically how these inhibitors interact with the protein. So completely different mechanism. And because they have different mechanisms, these drugs, that means they're going to have different resistance profiles. And I'm going to talk a bit about what's a resistance profile, what does it look like, and break it down a little bit. So protease inhibitors are active site mechanism-based inhibitors. And these all then, because they have the same type of mechanism, they're structurally a little bit different. But that means that they would have a similar resistance profile, sequence profile. If they have the same mechanism, they're going to have the same type of resistance profile. So there's new drugs with new targets being developed. As I have not worked in this area for some time now, but this assay still stands the test of time because the drugs are still in use. But there are new drugs always being developed. The pharmaceutical industry is obviously actively involved in developing new retroviral antiviral drugs. because drug resistance is a problem. It's a moving target, and you have to keep coming up with new therapeutic strategies. So these are fusion inhibitors, as I mentioned. Integrase inhibitors are not now part of the VirusSeq assay, but they are being used in clinical practice. And so this is what the enzyme actually looks like. The structure of the enzyme, the reverse transcriptase enzyme, it's actually a heterodimer, so it's got two components. And so it actually forms what looks like a hand and an arm. So it's hard to see, but you can see these what look like fingers sticking out. And it actually holds the DNA, RNA, kind of in its hand and processes it. It's really quite amazing. The first time I saw this, it's like, wow, that is really cool. So here's the RNA template and the newly formed nascent cDNA strand. And these mutations, so the virus, again, evolves in the presence, or if it replicates, it's able to replicate in the presence of these drugs, you can also transmit and obtain, be infected with drug-resistant viruses. So, you know, a patient may be, in fact, this happens regularly now with resistance profiles, these in the population, a person will inherit or be infected with resistant viruses. These are the mutations that confer resistance, and they're in a certain region. And that's because this region is where the activity of the inhibitor is. And so the active site is right in here. And then this hydrophobic pocket, it's kind of like the hand down in here in the palm. That's where mutations occur for the non-nucleoside or non-nucleotide. They bind into that hydrophobic pocket. So mutations in this region will basically block the binding of the NNRTI with the virus, the protein. And so in terms of protease is a really interesting enzyme, HIV protease. Look at all these mutations clustered all over the place. So this enzyme can tolerate 90% of its amino acids changing, and it still functions, and that's just mind-blowing. You know, I was blown away when I first found this out, and I think a lot of people were. How on earth can a protein change 90% of its sequence and still function? That's crazy. But it does. And so basically, this is where the active site is in here, and this is where the active site mechanism-based inhibitor binds. The virus actually opens up and closes like a clam. The protein opens up and takes substrate in. So there are very little sequence difference between the drug-resistant and drug-sensitive, structural differences between the sensitive and resistant protease. It's really a magnificent enzyme. It can do this. But it's tricky because you can form resistance in a lot of places, and that's, again, a lot of targets to hit. So in terms of actually categorizing mutations, this is the nomenclature. So D67N, this is the position on the protein, and this is the wild type, and then aspartic acid is the wild type amino acid, and asparagine is the mutation that occurs. And so it's actually the genetic code, of course, is where the mutation actually occurs. If the mutation changes the protein, then it would be notated and functionally significant. It's not a silent mutation. So as you can see, you can change a G to A here to change that protein amino acid from D to N. So that's how we, you know, notate mutations. And so this particular mutation is associated with the thymidine analogs, so it confers resistance in reverse transcriptase. It's known, not specifically, but the thymidine analogs do tend to have this mutation that occurs. And so this is it's kind of a broad overview of what the different drug classes of HIV look like in terms of their resistance profiles. Again, resistance profile meaning that an amino acid is changing in a part of the protein that's significant for, it basically can function in the presence of these inhibitors. And so they really do tend to the mutations here are lumped together by functional class of the inhibitors. So these inhibitors have similar mechanisms. These are the active site mechanism-based inhibitors. And, of course, because the structure is different between these, you'll see subtle differences. But the overall mechanism is the same, and so the resistance profiles look similar. It's the same thing with the, when you're comparing the non-nucleoside reverse transcriptase inhibitors with the active site mechanism-based inhibitors, the resistance profiles look quite different. It's because they're targeting those drugs are targeting a different spot on the protein than these mechanism-based inhibitors. So this is HIV protease, and again, a lot of work has been done. You can see some trends here. Of course, there's differences in all of these drug structures, so they're going to interact with the protein in different ways. But you can see some global trends in terms of the resistance profiles based on the drug class. And then this is the entry inhibitors and integrase inhibitors. So these are new drug targets with evolving resistance as well. So the term cross-resistance is important, in particular for the protease enzymes and inhibitors. And so cross-resistance occurs between different drugs of the same class, and it's really because the mechanism of the drugs is very, very similar. And so you saw that in the previous slide where drugs in the same class had very similar resistance profiles. And so, for example, if a patient is resistant to one protease inhibitor, the chances are likely that it's going to be resistant to other protease inhibitors, especially ones that are very structurally similar. So that's the term cross-resistance. It's a problem for any drugs that have the same mechanism. So that's just a way, again, you usually see this in the sequence data, that these drugs with the same mechanism have similar resistance, sequence perturbations and resistance profiles. And so now I'm going to talk a bit, my inner geek is going to come out a bit, so my apologies, how to develop an assay. And so this is what I spent probably the last 15 years doing, helping develop new assays and also working then on new microfluidic assay platforms. The last 5 years I've transitioned into working exclusively with customers, which has been a really fun adventure, helping people actually use the technology, be successful with it, and particularly move into the translational world of clinical trials, molecular stratification of primarily cancer patients at this point, but understanding genetic signatures that are relevant to a cancer phenotype. And because, as you know, molecular tests and drugs are being developed in cancer as well. And this is actually a phenotypic, I mean, it's a genetic test, but it's breaking out a phenotype, in other words, a drug resistance phenotype. And that's really important information for being successful in treating patients. So this test is now sold by Abbott Molecular, but it was developed at Applied Biosystems. And so I remember being a graduate student trying to finish my thesis, and I got an email from an investigator saying, hey, are you interested in industry, and would you like to use your HIV experience to help us develop an HIV genotyping assay for clinical practice? And I said, wow, that sounds really exciting. Sure. And so the rest is history. It's been a really exciting place to be for the last 20 years in terms of helping, one, build these tests, and two, seeing them change how treatment decisions are made. So this is the original patent. It's actually been issued now three separate times. Because the reason why is that it's continuing to evolve as we get more sequence information on HIV and new drug targets. In fact, the original assay that we developed at Applied Biosystems is now bigger because the 3' end of reverse transcriptase is important for drug resistance. And so the folks at Celera actually added on to the assay and made the amplicon bigger so that they could get more sequence information. And so this is what the assay actually does in terms of the physical workflow. You actually purify, you take patient plasma, and you purify the RNA out of the patient plasma. And so this is also being done concurrently for viral load, and you're familiar with what viral load means. That's the number of copies of a virus per mil of plasma. So that's a very important concurrent measurement to make. The sequence information is a lot more complicated, but the viral load tells you if you've got replicating virus in your system. So the front end or the purification kit is actually the same between the viral load, and we designed it that way so that clinical labs doing this test would be able to use the same sample when they're determining the titer of the virus, the number of copies, and getting the drug resistance genotype. So basically you take sample and spin it down, purify the viral RNA out, And then you do what's called a reverse transcription. So you use reverse transcriptase, actually, to create DNA. And then you amplify up the DNA. And what you do is you target just a specific region of, in this case, this is Sanger sequencing. So this is not next-gen sequencing. This is old-school Sanger sequencing. But you target about a 1.8 kb region of HIV Pol. That's the 5' end of it. Amplify it up and then sequence it using 7 sequencing primers. So that's how you actually do the workflow. So this workflow requires multiple steps. It has to be done in what's called a high-complexity CLIA lab. It's CLIA is a lab that it can run tests. And even though this is FDA-approved, CLIA labs actually can run and develop their own tests. So, but we did decide to go through the FDA approval process for this test. And so the people that interpret the results of this test are infectious disease clinicians. And again, not being a clinician myself, I'm not exactly sure how the pharmacist would be involved with this, but it would be in consultation with probably with an infectious disease clinician for interpreting the results that come out of this test. So basically you run, you amplify up in sequence, then you run on a 3100, which is a capillary electrophoresis sequencer, and then you get the data, and there's a separate module of software that was built. And this module was actually built specifically for this application. So it has a custom software package. And developing that custom software package really made this information accessible to the clinicians. So clinicians don't have to do all the sequence analysis themselves. You get a report out that tells you what the drug resistance profile of the patient is. That work actually took as much in terms of resources as did developing the bench part of this assay. And it was visionary of the people that were leading this project, Leslie Dow is my boss, to fund the informatics, custom informatics, at the same time that she was developing the assay, that we were developing the assay. So that's what made it accessible to clinicians. So in terms of the assay itself, we designed and worked hard on what we did is we took lots and lots of sequence information from what's called a clade. A clade is a set of HIV viruses that are genetically have things in common, sequence information in common. This test was designed specifically for the clade B virus. And so clades are like families of viruses, and they have different clades of HIV. They're usually geographic in nature, but they have to do with defining, you know, relationship between the sequences. So in terms of the assay design, we had to look for regions of conservation so we could put PCR primers down. And that took a lot of work, and it's a process of continual refinement as you get more and more sequences. So you wanted to put the primers here to amplify up this part of the Pol gene. And then we designed, and I worked on these extensively, Sanger sequencing requires sequencing primers into the template so that because 1.8 kb can't be covered by 2 primers. So we had forward and reverse primers. In this case, we had to design 2 primers because there's a lot of sequence heterogeneity in this region between the GAG and the Pol gene. A lot of sequence heterogeneity, lots of SNPs, gaps in the sequence. So we required 2 primers here. And so all that information, it takes about 2 days to run this assay, actually. So you have to purify the RNA, amplify it up, do the cycles, clean up the PCR product, cycle sequence, get the data, and analyze the data. So it's a 2-day process. This is what is called an electropherogram. Again, some of you, I'm sure, I don't know if any of you have actually done Sanger. It's kind of an old school sequencing technology, but it's still being used clinically and for other purposes too. What you can do is these are individual nucleotides that are being called out. And this means you've got 2 nucleotides in the same position on the sequence. So this means there's possibly been a mutation occurring in HIV. So that means there's 2 species here. This is just a single nucleotide. So each color represents a nucleotide. So when you've got 2 of them in the same place, usually the peaks are like half the size. If it's genomic DNA, you have a 50-50 mix of it. You know, if you have an A and a G. But in viruses, we have what are called quasi-species. So viruses, you can have multiple individuals or multiple viruses in the same sample. So in terms of doing the sequence analysis, this was, again, a big part of developing this test, was coming up with custom software, too. So we used ABI at the time was the world leader in sequencing, and they had a lot of experience doing this. But basically, we had to come up with cutoffs. So, for example, with Sanger sequencing, a conservative cutoff is 20% minor variant. That's kind of where you can see signal above noise. So as I showed you before in that other slide, this looks kind of like a 50-50 mix, but you can go to 80-20. So nucleotide 1 at position X is maybe 20%, and nucleotide 2 at position X is 80%. That's kind of the limit of where you can call the minor variant. And so that was a rule that we put into the test, that you had to have 20% of the total population of the minor variant to be able to call it as a variant. So one of the things you can see over time, and I did this, was really interesting and kind of depressing at the same time, but I had patients that I was following along a time course with collaborators. And you would see the resistance mutations gradually going from a little blip up to maybe 20%, then 50%, then 75%. And you saw that person becoming resistant to a drug. And so you knew then that that drug would no longer work for that patient. But so that's actually why it's important to be able to see minor variants, so that you can see resistance emerging over time. So what we did with the software is we came up with a report. And the report basically said you have these mutations, and these are, and we have lookup tables. That, and the pharmaceutical industry figured a lot of this out. They did early genotyping studies where they saw and they genotyped patients in clinical trials and saw resistance profiles emerging associated with clinical outcomes. So, for example, if your virus titer is increasing over time and your CD4 counts go down, that means you've got virus replicating in your system. You can also correlate that to a sequence and mutations occurring. And so if you can make that relationship between the phenotype, you know, high viral load and low CD4 count and other clinical features and the presence of mutations, that's how you do what's called an association between a genotype and a phenotype. So that information was critical to be able to create these lookup tables in the software that associated particular mutations with resistance to drugs. So that information was known and put into the software. So basically, we prepare a data analysis report, and it gives clinicians information on the drug sensitivities and resistance profiles for the different drugs that they are prescribing. And so, again, we built this custom application for this assay. This is just for HIV genotyping. So it basically aligns the sequence data and analyzes it, looks for the presence of mutations, and compares the patient sequence to a reference sequence of wild type, meaning no mutations at all. And so that information is then put into a report. So it relates the genotype information you get from the test to clinical information for drug resistance. And so a really nice repository of this information, Bob Schaefer was one of the pioneers in collating information from HIV genotyping data from the pharmaceutical industry. In fact, he partnered with them to produce this really powerful database called the HIV Sequence Database. So if any of you are curious or interested in this database, I would encourage you to take a look at it. It's really the kind of a world repository for sequence information on HIV drug resistance. So in summary, this has been a kind of a lot to cover, but drug resistance is a big problem, and we need to pay attention to it. There's a continuing evolution of tools that people like me are developing to assess drug resistance in clinically meaningful ways. But I would say that, you know, we're kind of behind the curve in this as a society. We have antibiotics and antivirals used. Antibiotics are the bigger problem in terms of resistance. They're used in, agriculture extensively. I'm a big organic person. I like to grow my own veggies and fruit if I can. I also like to buy organic meat. I mean, one of the reasons why is that, a lot of animal-producing farmers and such use antibiotics to keep their herds healthy. But the problem is that introduces resistance into the human population. So it's something that we're going to have to tackle as a society in a better way. So what I've talked a bit about is specifically how do you develop an assay for drug determination of drug resistance. How mechanistically, how do these inhibitors interact with the proteins, and how does resistance occur? I mean, resistance occurs when viruses or bacteria can replicate in the presence of these and evade, essentially through their own replicative processes, the action of the drugs. And so viruses and bacteria are always evolving and replicating unless you stop them. And so by stopping them, you develop these protein inhibitors, which can block the activity of a particular enzyme. Hitting multiple enzymes with therapeutic agents at the same time is called highly active antiretroviral therapy. This is a strategy. Basically, stopping multiple targets at the same time effectively, you know, is a great strategy for stopping replication of the virus. Anyway, in terms of developing a product, you can do this now. We have lots of genomic information. NanoString, the company I work for, now has a platform where you can count molecules without doing PCR. So we're now kind of getting into the realm of being able to directly detect and count molecules without having to amplify them. Next-gen sequencing still relies on amplification to be able to get signal. But we're now moving into this place where we can do this sort of single molecule analysis. This is not, again, not a quantitative, it's a high-precision ratiometric technology. We're not actually doing the concentration of molecules. We're capturing a subset of them and counting them. But we're moving now, people are testing these nanopore sequencers. We're actually going to be able to sequence, you know, individual molecules. So the technology is really evolving in the biotech tool space. And we're able to actually do a lot of high-throughput sequencing. We can get information on, you know, the sequence of an organism for $1,000. I mean, the technology is continually improving. I'm going to stop here and just leave a little time for questions. I know I've kind of given you a lot of information, but it's an exciting place to be, and I'm hoping to help you guys get comfortable with some of the lingo and the thinking around how to develop these tests and how to use them. So thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it. Sure. So there's other types of viruses that can affect the immune system. Again, I'm not a clinician, but the acquired immune deficiency syndrome, as it's defined, has been, you know, conclusively identified to be caused by the HIV-1 virus. There's other types of HIV. HIV-2 is a virus. It's a related strain of virus, but it's actually quite different in terms of its sequence, especially in like the GP120, the surface proteins. But it's part of the HIV family of viruses. So, yeah, I think the science is pretty conclusive at this point. Again, not being a clinician that understands immune disorders, and there are other viruses that cause, and I just don't have the technical background scientifically to say, you know, I'm not an infectious disease clinician. So that's a good question, though.
Mm-hmm. When a newly person becomes infected from like their partner, do they get the resistant genotype from the person or the original strain?
That's actually a really good question. So resistant viruses tend to not be as fit, and I think Noah's going to talk. Are you going to talk about this? But viruses can be transferred from one person to another, and you can get a resistant virus. But it ultimately needs to replicate in the presence. I mean, it needs to be able to replicate and infect you. So, I'm going to defer some of that to Noah because he's more cognizant of some of the statistics around this. But resistant strains can be passed from one person to another, not just HIV, but other bacterial strains as well. Replicative fitness is an issue. In fact, you could have strains that revert to wild type because they want to go back to being more efficient in terms of being able to replicate. So because the viruses are always evolving sequence-wise, and that's when a reverse transcriptase doesn't have proofreading ability, so it allows mutations to be introduced at random across the sequence landscape. And so viruses that are fitter, if they're not being inhibited by viruses, they'll grow up and grow out and take over in terms of their replicative fitness is better. As long as they're allowed to replicate, the ones that replicate faster will kind of take over. So it's a complicated subject, though, and I think it's going to be discussed in more detail in part two of the seminar.
When you were talking about the commercial platforms that mm-hmm. are now available, mm-hmm. are you saying that, like, when a patient, because I'm guessing his heart, if they're not compliant with all the drugs, they can get resistant to the whole entire therapy, essentially, you have to work, you have to take, like, I guess, well, the regimen's very specific.
Yeah, yeah.
So then a clinician's going to want to genotype their sequence and then compare it to these platforms to see, like, where their resistance is going to be developing. Is that the whole purpose of these platforms?
So the question is really trying to understand what the drug resistance assay, what's its purpose, and it's to identify at least initially what drugs is this person sensitive to based on its profile, its sequence profile. So
remember how you showed us like the low ones that there were two together?
Right. Yeah, let me just go back to, and let me just show you this slide. It's hard to see, but it gives you kind of a snapshot of these are mutations for the different drug classes. So, for example, this is a common mutation that occurs for these particular reverse transcriptase, mechanism-based reverse transcriptase inhibitors. So if you saw this mutation pop up on your report, then you would say that this person has virus. As long as it's more than 20%, I mean, you can see resistance emerging over time, but let's say this person had a definitive, you know, I think it's K65R mutation, that would mean that person would be resistant to these drugs. So that's the lookup table that the software has. Yeah, it actually assigns. So it basically says, so the patient's sequence in comparison to the wild-type sequence has this mutation. This amino acid has changed. And then it'll has a lookup table that associates that mutation and others with a particular drug, a drug class, and it'll say that you're resistant to this particular drug class because you have this mutational profile. So it's essentially relating genotype information to phenotype. And there are actual tests that do what are called phenotype tests. That's a different, not to get too complicated, but there are tests that actually do a phenotype analysis. This is a genotype analysis that's inferring a phenotype based on sequence data from large amounts, you know, from clinical studies that found this relationship a priori. I mean, it found the relationship before. So I better pass the baton over. Thank you guys for listening. I appreciate it.
Hello? Yes? I just heard that somebody's posting them to Facebook. I'm Noah Zaitlin. I'm in the Department of Medicine, CSF. My lab works on statistical genetics. So we look at genetic variation in human and mouse and virus and any organism and try to understand how that genetic variation shapes phenotypes, and also how external pressures like selection and evolution shape our genomes. So today I'm going to be talking about the genetic variation in humans and the genetic variation in HIV and how those two genomes interact with one another and how those interactions shape HIV resistance in the presence of drugs and without the presence of drugs. So you're all going to be pharmacists, is that okay? So this is an outline of my talk, so I'm going to start with just a brief overview. This is pharmacogenomics, so probably at this point you guys have seen these first couple slides over and over again, but just to make sure that we're all on the same page, I'm going to sort of outline some basics of human genetic variation and GWAS, and then I'm going to talk about variation in HIV, which is very, very different than the variation that occurs in humans. And then I'm going to talk about the variation that we observe in response to HIV infection across the human population and the genetic basis for that variation in HIV response. So some people get infected with HIV and they do very well. Some people do very poorly. Some people respond very well to drugs and some people respond very poorly. I'm going to talk about what genes are involved in that and how they were discovered. And then I'll talk a little bit about how HIV variation can vary its ability to respond to drugs. So some HIV sequences respond very well and some respond very poorly. So what I'm hoping that you'll take away, and you can always stop me and ask questions along the way, but what I want you to leave this lecture with is an understanding of the genetic basis of human variation and how that regulates the response to HIV infection, the mechanism by which HIV evades the human immune system, the importance of, so there's some overlap with the last talk, but the utility of HIV genotyping in drug treatments and the influence of HIV and human genetic variation in shaping HIV outcomes. Here's the background, Human Genetics 101. So we have a genome. It's made up of the sequence, A, C, G, and T. It's about 3 billion letters long. And we differ by 0.1% of our DNA. And the majority of the differences between a pair of people are things called single nucleotide polymorphisms, where if we look at a particular position in a lot of individuals in everybody's genome, some of us will have an A there, other people have a T there. The A and T are called alleles. And we call A the major allele because it shows up a lot. So a lot of people have the phenotype that's caused by A. Fewer people have the phenotype that's caused by T. T is the minor allele. And if we look across the genome, there's about 10 million of these things lying around at some reasonable frequency. And if we start thinking about how this shapes traits, we can look at the differences between people, and a lot of these differences are caused by environmental factors. So if you smoke, you're going to get lung cancer. If you don't smoke, you probably won't. So that's an environmental cause of a different phenotype. But other phenotypes are caused by variation in the genome. So here's an example of a SNP that changes whether you have straight hair or curly hair. So the question of interest is how we can find the SNPs that cause these differences between people. And the sort of vastly popular way to do this these days is to conduct something called an association study. So in an association study, we collect a bunch of individuals, call cases. These are the people who are sick, who have the phenotype of interest, and a bunch of people who are controls, who don't have the disease. And we look at each position along the genome, and we look for positions that are very different. So in this case, you can see all the people who have the disease have an A, and all the controls, the people who don't have the disease, have a T. So a SNP that's correlated or associated with the disease helps us find the regions of the genome that are responsible. And so, this is a really nice case where we call it just sort of a Mendelian disease, where you can look in and see a particular variant and see that some that causes the disease or doesn't. This is a very rare case. Usually you have a couple extra A's within the cases and a couple fewer A's within the controls. This kind of gets the idea across. So HIV genetic variation is very different than human genetic variation. So there's a couple billion people on Earth. We vary at 0.1% of our genomes, and our genomes are 3 billion bases long. But when we look at HIV, the genome's only 10,000 bases long, so it's tiny, right? And the copy mechanism introduces errors at a rate of 1 in 10,000. So that means there's one mutation every time the virus replicates. For humans, if we think about 10,000 bases, the mutation rate in humans is much, much smaller. It's something, I think, 1 in 10 to the 7th, so 1 in 10 million, something like that. And the amount of virus that's produced inside of an individual is much larger than the number of people that are produced around the world. So if you look inside of a person, they're producing something like a billion viruses every day. So if you think about this HIV genome, HIV is sort of exploring every single possible mutation, point mutation, along its entire genome every single day. And these mutations, these variants that arise, alter its phenotype. So some of them are really bad for HIV. So some of these virions will accrue a mutation that will break it. And so it won't be very fit, it won't replicate, but other ones might make it more efficient. And efficient is, or fit, is something that's defined with respect to the environment that it's in. So if you're in a particular individual with a particular immune system and a particular drug regimen, HIV is kind of searching along this space of different mutations to try to find the set of variants that will make it replicate at a very high rate. It's like you can think of it as natural selection. If you guys have thought about natural selection and evolution, this is evolution on a very, very small scale within an individual. There's some environment, there's some replication, and there's some, advantage, fitness advantage for some mutation. So basically HIV is evolving to become better at copying itself within an individual in the current environment of that individual. So you guys saw this, or a different version of this cartoon during Camille's talk. But this is this very small genome, this 10,000 base pair genome, and you have these different genes that are responsible for different functions of HIV. If we kind of zoom in to one of these genes, and then we sequence that in an individual, you heard about how we can sequence and look for variants that are causing resistance to drugs. Here's a plot of all the different sequences, not even all of them, a bunch of different sequences in a particular gene, in a particular region of a particular gene in one individual. So all these different colors here represent positions that are mutated, and this is an amino acid space. So you can see there's a lot of variation. HIV is really looking around inside of an individual for different ways to optimize itself, and it looks around because of its very high mutation rate. So now we have human genome, and then we have the HIV genome that's living inside of humans. And now I'm going to sort of switch gears a little bit and talk about variation in response to infection with HIV. So what this plot is showing is the T cell count and the number of copies of the virus across time. So if we think about these immune cells, these CD4 T cells, these are the cells that are trying to kill the cells that are infected with HIV. So it's this battle. There's two players. There's the HIV, the virus, that's trying to be eradicated, and then there's these CD4 T cells, which are busy trying to eradicate the virus. So as the number of HIV viruses goes up, it's kind of HIV winning. And as the number of T cells goes up, that's like T cells winning. And there's a lot of variation between individuals in the way these curves work over time. So some people will get HIV, and they'll never get a lot of virus. They'll just stay at a very low count their whole life, and their T cell count will stay very high. Other people, they get infected with HIV, and HIV is just massively successful. It comes in, it replicates like crazy, it kills all the T cells, and their T cell counts just diminish. And because these T cells are responsible not just for attacking HIV, but all sorts of other viruses and bacteria that infect individuals, they end up getting very sick, and that's what AIDS is, because it's not just that they're, you know, it's not just that they're losing the ability to fight HIV with these T cells, they're losing the ability to fight anything. So I'm going to present some results of this study where they collected thousands of individuals who were not on any therapy, and they measured these CD4 T cell counts, and then they measured the number of copies of HIV. And then, so the question, and then they divided them into these two groups, and they called them progressors or non-progressors or controllers or non-controllers, depending on sort of which community you're talking to. And what they wanted to do was find which genes were responsible for preventing HIV from doing very well, because these might be genes that can be leveraged to improve therapy for HIV infection. Okay, so how do we find the gene? So it's a genome-wide association study of HIV response. We collect two groups, individuals who progress very quickly from HIV to AIDS, and then a group of individuals who carry HIV, in this case, for decades, and they never develop AIDS. None of them are on any drugs. And then we do a GWAS. So we look at every position, and we ask, are there any positions in the genome where the people who get sick have a very different set of variants, a very different allele frequency? So all A's, for example, in the people who get sick, and all T's in the individuals who stay healthy. And have you guys seen plots like this before, these Manhattan plots? So this is a Manhattan plot of the results of this study, and it looks very weird compared to most of the Manhattan plots that you've seen. There's this massive whopping signal here at the MHC locus. So the top plot is a Manhattan plot. This plot is something called a QQ plot, which is showing the distribution of all of the variants along the genome. And when it deviates from this x-axis, from this diagonal line, it means there's still signal left. So if you take out all of the regions of the genome that are all of the SNPs that are in these two regions, MHC and CCR5, you can see you get back to this diagonal line, which means at least in this study, there's no genes left that they could detect. So all of the big signal was contained in these two loci. And then this last section here shows the difference in the percent of the sample who have the number of SNPs that were found to be protective. So what you can see is that as you add protective SNPs, you get a lot more individuals who are controllers, whereas if you have very few protective SNPs, you're much more likely to rapidly progress from HIV to AIDS. So this was a very strong signal. So now, you know, this GWAS has been conducted, and we find these two regions. MHC is one region, and CCR5 is another gene, right, another region. And now we want to know what is it about variation in these genes that's conferring this protection from HIV. And so just as a quick review, in order to understand how, you know, HIV response is affected by these genes, we need to just kind of look back at this HIV life cycle and then do a little background on the human immune system. So HIV comes in through into CD4 cells through this receptor called CCR5. And then once it's in, it does some replication and then buds out and spreads to the rest of the genome. And at every step, or almost every step inside of this life cycle, you have drugs that have been developed to prevent HIV from doing its job at each stage. So there's drugs that have been developed to prevent HIV from getting in. There are drugs that are preventing HIV from getting into the DNA. This is getting into the cell from copying itself. Once HIV has made it in, so once it's gotten past CCR5, forgot to point this out. So we saw CCR5 was one of these SNPs, was one of these variants, and CCR5 is this gene here. So this gene, which is kind of the gateway into the cell, is the gene that has this protective effect. So if you have certain mutations in this gene, you're protecting HIV. And so we'll see how that's working in a second. The other gene that was involved, the other system that was involved, is the MHC, and in particular, a gene called HLA. So once HIV is in the cell, it's subjected to this part of the immune system called the MHC class 1 immune system. So when you think about an infection with any kind of virus, in order for your immune system to combat that virus, it has to know that you have an infection. And so the way that your body does that, the way that your cells do that, is through this sort of survey and presentation mechanism. It's really beautiful. So there's all these proteins that are floating around in your cell. And some of those, if you're infected with a virus, will be viral proteins. So it could be HIV, cold, flu, polio, whatever you have is in the cell. And because it's in the cell, those proteins, along with all of your just sort of natural proteins, are sitting there floating around, and they're sampled. So there's these things called proteasomes that are also in your cell, and they're moving around, and they just kind of grab proteins randomly, and they chop them up into these little chunks called peptides. So they're short segments of 9 nucleotides, and then they get bound onto something called MHC or HLA. So one of these little peptides will come in and bind onto HLA, and the small segments are called epitopes. This HLA is this waiter here, and he comes up to the surface of the cell, and he puts it out for the immune system to see. So all of the cells in your body have all of these guys on the cell surface kind of showing off what's going on inside of the cell. And there's these guys called T cells. It's one type of immune cell. There's lots of types of immune cells, but these are the ones that we're interested in for HIV. And they're running around your body looking at every single cell. And they've been trained to know what's in you already. So there's this process called thymic selection. So when you're developing your immune system, all these T cells are shown you. So they know what you are. And so if they see an epitope that they don't recognize, they go and they recruit the rest of the immune system to come in and kill the cell. So we'll go through some more details of how that works in a second. But the thing to remember is that this MHC was the other gene that was involved in regulating risk for HIV. So it was determining whether you progressed or did not progress to HIV. So now I'm going to talk about the mechanism of how these work, how CCR5 mechanism works, and how the MHC mechanism works. CCR5, when they zoomed in and they looked at the particular mutations, they found that the mutation that was conferring the protection was something called the delta 32 mutation. And that mutation was the 32nd amino acid in this protein, CCR5. And what it did was it prevented CCR5 from working at all. So CCR5 is this protein that lives on the cell surface of the T cells that HIV comes and recognizes and then uses to get inside of the cell. But when you have this delta 32 mutation, CCR5 is kind of broken. It doesn't show up. It doesn't seem like there's any sort of other adverse effects. So if there's some effect of CCR5 in humans, we can't really observe any adverse health benefits. So this mutation, the CCR5 delta 32 mutation, is very protective against HIV. And in fact, you can't get HIV infection if you have this mutation because HIV can't get into your cells. So if you have two copies of this, there are no cells in your body that HIV will make it into, and so you're resistant. This mutation exists at a pretty high frequency in Europe, in Northern Europe especially. I think it's above 10%. And sort of interestingly, it's also protective against the Black Plague. So back when the Black Death was sweeping through Europe and killing people, people who had this mutation were also resistant to that. In other countries, it occurs at a much lower frequency, and I think the lowest is in Africa. It's below 1%. CCR5 has been an interesting target for thinking about therapy. There isn't really a protocol for introducing this mutation yet, but it has happened a couple times. In a couple instances, people who needed a bone marrow transplant because of adverse effects of AIDS were given transplants from individuals who were carriers of this delta 32 mutation. And so when they got the bone marrow transplant, all of the new T cells that they were given from this bone marrow transplant contained this delta 32 mutation, and so they were resistant to HIV, and they've done very well sort of going forward. These individuals have been resequenced, and there's been no evidence of the virus. They're not on any drugs. So it's not really a viable treatment option because it's so risky to transplant somebody's entire bone marrow. But it has been really interesting to see it in those individuals. Sort of going forward, I don't know, has anybody heard of this CRISPR-Cas9 thing? Anybody reading, like, New York Times? There was this professor over at Berkeley who a couple years ago discovered this new protein called CRISPR-Cas9, and it's very likely she's going to win the Nobel Prize for it in the next couple years. It's kind of one of the biggest advances in human genetics or genetics in general. And people have been considering this as a mechanism for introducing this mutation. But there's a lot of ethical questions. That's why it's been in the New York Times a lot. So you might have heard about some attempts to edit human genomes in China and some backlash against that. So what it is there's this protein Cas and CRISPR where you can insert some guide RNA that will target a particular region of the genome and come in there and either delete it or insert a sequence that you like. And so some people are exploring the possibility of taking an individual's T cells out of their body, introducing the CCR5 mutation or just deleting that gene and putting those cells back in order to make a cell population that's HIV resistant. This is sort of kind of sci-fi-ish, but it's definitely something people are thinking about. Somebody have a question? Yeah.
What does CCR5 normally do?
Yeah, so it's expressed, but it's not really well characterized, and people without it don't seem to get sick, so kind of unknown. This is kind of a zoom in of the region to go into more detail of the changes in this HLA molecule. So we were talking about CCR5, and now I'm going to switch over to this other region that was involved called the MHC. So the MHC has a lot of different genes in it, and a lot of the genes are called HLA genes, and these are the genes that were like the waiter guy. He's an HLA gene. There's lots of other genes inside of the MHC. And this is a zoom in of the Manhattan plot. So this is the minus log 10 p value, and these are different SNPs that were in the study. And this is where the SNP maps onto this HLA molecule. And then here again, we have the progressors and non-progressors as a function of the different amino acids that exist according to these mutations. So the point is just that for certain mutations in these positions, you have a very different distribution of progressors and controllers, where, for example, here, if you have the methionine, you're going to get, you know, sick when you get HIV relative to somebody here who has the tyrosine. So there's this variation in this presenter guy, and that's controlling whether you're a progressor or a controller of HIV. To understand how that mechanism of HIV resistance works, I'm going to go back to a different version of that cartoon with the chicken. So here is this virus, this particular cartoon is actually demonstrating how vaccines work. So vaccines work by leveraging this same mechanism for resistance, but we're going to ignore this for a second. We'll just come back to it. So we have some protein, for example, HIV virus, that's in the body. It gets chopped up by the proteasomes, and it gets loaded onto these HLA molecules, and these float up and show off these little peptides to T cells. And when the T cells come and they recognize that this peptide is foreign, they recruit some killer cells to come in and eat the cell. So the way a vaccine works is by giving some virus that's been sort of knocked out, or a lot of vaccines work this way. And so basically you get more efficient at doing this presentation. So when you do get infected with polio, for example, you've already developed a mechanism to sort of mount a response against that particular epitope. So this is what it looks like. It's kind of cool. You have this is one of these killer cells, and this is a cell that's presenting an epitope that's been recognized, right? And so you have this guy come in, and he basically eats the cell and destroys it. So that's the normal course of action. That's what you want to have happen. So this is a zoom in of the surface of that guy, that waiter, holding onto an epitope. So this is HLA. It's got these two grooves, and it holds this peptide inside. So here's some little part of the HIV genome, and here's HLA holding onto it from some different views. So that's sitting on the surface for your immune system to recognize. Now, remember, there's all these SNPs in HLA. So this is, it's really interesting. It's the most polymorphic region of the genome. So you might have SNPs here and there when you look at a random genomic segment. But when you look inside of HLA, you have almost every single base mutated, and there's tons and tons of different HLA types out there in the population. So what happens is the mutation, the amino acids that you have along this exterior part of your HLA determine which part of the HIV genome you grab onto. So that epitope that's sitting there is a function of both the HIV sequence that you're infected with and your HLA variant. So here's, to kind of make it clear, some sequence. This is actually SIV, but it doesn't really matter. You have some virus, and here are the different types of HLA. So this type will bind here preferentially, this type will bind here, and you have different immune cells that like to bind onto different parts of the genome. So people with a certain HLA will prefer certain parts of HIV to make and present to the immune system, and other people will present other parts. So if we look at a longer stretch, these blocks are different epitopes that have been found through a different set of experiments. So these are known epitopes of HIV. And there's lots of different ones that we can choose to grab onto. And so when we grab onto one, the way HIV escapes now from the immune system is that it mutates that position. So so I have, let's say, some HLA type that makes me grab this. So I've grabbed onto this part of HIV, and that's the part of HIV that I like, and it's the part that I'm going to show off to the immune system. So I grab onto it, I'm sitting there, that's all I'm showing from HIV. I don't show the whole thing because that's my HLA sequence. Someone else might grab there, but I like that, and so I'm showing it off. And so what happens is HIV is sitting there mutating, and when there's a mutation, it can mutate the HIV sequence. And so instead of that blue triangle, now there's this red triangle, and that represents a change in the sequence of the epitope. And so when it comes up, it blocks this T cell receptor reaction. So it doesn't know, the immune system no longer knows that that's an epitope of HIV. It has to mount an immune response to a whole different epitope, which takes, you know, a couple days. And so there's sort of this repetitive process where I hone in on something, my immune system starts to target it, and then HIV mutates away. So all of the cells with that particular variant of HIV get killed, and HIV, a different version of HIV, is now affecting cells, and you know, the immune system is playing this kind of cat and mouse game. So I grab something, HIV mutates it, I grab something else, HIV mutates that, and everything's kind of being chased away. The issue is that the HIV mutations don't just make it resistant against the human immune system, they also affect the function of HIV. So it's not all great. HIV without an immune system is just trying to make itself copy faster and faster and faster. So the faster it copies, the more efficient that particular sequence, the better it is for HIV. When you introduce a selective pressure like an immune system, HIV has to mutate away from that. So this could be some initial sequence of HIV where if these two parts are bound together, it's really efficient. But maybe I chose this as my epitope. So HIV mutates this, and it's true that that prevents HIV from getting recognized by the immune system so it doesn't get killed very fast, but it also broke this connection. So now it copies at a much slower rate, right? So it's copying slower and slower, but what will happen is if there's another mutation, it will become fit again. So it's not just that HIV needs to mutate away from the immune system. It has to mutate to achieve a very high level of fitness too. Just as a summary for that section, actually, let me make one more point here. The reason that certain HLA sequences are conferring this protection is because they're grabbing onto parts of HIV that are so core to its life cycle that it's very difficult for HIV to mutate away from the epitope. So you can imagine that somebody's epitope who grabs onto some part of HIV that doesn't really matter, those people with that type of HLA aren't protected from HIV, from the CTL escape. HIV can mutate it with no problem. It's like some mutation over here that doesn't really affect its fitness at all, and then it escapes. But somebody who grabs on here, HIV has a much harder time. And so the more sort of fundamental the sequence that a particular individual's HLA is targeting within HIV, so it's sort of a complicated logic. But Are you lost? You can ask a question. So think about two people with two different HLA sequences. One person grabs onto a part of HIV that is not important to HIV. It's like, you know, it grabs onto its hair. And so it, you know, it's happy to cut its hair, goes, runs off and makes more HIV viruses. But, you know, another person's HLA grabs onto its throat, can't really mutate its throat very easily to get away. And so that's why variation in HLA can confer resistance or protection. It's a really core element. And actually, it's one of the elements that is most responsible. You probably saw this in some of your other lectures when people were talking about drug response variation. HLA comes up over and over again in adverse effects of drugs because the drugs that you're giving are foreign, and so it's involved in regulation of foreign substance. Okay, so as a summary of how this CTL escape works, we have HIV, which lacks this error correction machinery. And so HIV has this very high mutation rate. And so as the immune system targets specific epitopes, viruses with mutations in those genes escape the immune system. But the protective HLA binds regions of the HIV genome that cannot mutate without causing a loss of function. So this is what everyone thinks, but it is just a working hypothesis. It's a very difficult thing to actually prove. So now I'm going to switch a little bit. So what I was talking about before was HIV within the context of an individual. So with an individual, you have HIV sort of mutating around to become very fit within an individual. But HIV is transferred between people, and people around the world have different immune systems. And so you can think of HIV as being selected on not by just an individual, but all of the people who live in a community. That is affecting sort of the average sequence of HIV. And so if this person with MHC type P gets infected with HIV, HIV is going to make all of these mutations to escape that individual's immune system. So it's becoming very fit for that individual. And then if this person transfers HIV to this person, they get the sequence that was optimized for that individual. And then it's going to mutate again. Maybe some of these things flip back. Some new mutations get added. And so when you're thinking about HIV sequence worldwide, you have to think about all of the people's immune systems together. And so, for example, if we look at a particular type of HLA, so this is called HLA-0201. It's very frequent in some parts of the world. So here in North America, it's at something like 54%, that part of HLA. And here in South Africa, it's almost at 0%. And if we look at HIV sequence with respect to different variants of that HLA, you can see these are different branches of HIV, and these are different mutations that exist, different variants that exist inside of the HLA. And so when you look around the world, the average HIV sequence varies dramatically as a function of the HLA types that live in that part of the world. Another selective pressure besides the immune system, which you guys were hearing about in the first part of today, was HIV drug resistance. So I'm going to go back and talk about this now, but more from the context of the HIV genome. So we have this HLA class 1 applying selective pressure to HIV, and this high mutation rate is allowing HIV to evolve. And with drug therapy, it's another form of selective pressure. It's the same idea, though. There are certain parts of the HIV genome, and they're applying pressure to the virus. And so here's a little cartoon of how it arises. So we have these HIV variants that come into an individual at the beginning or that are sort of mutated and floating around. And then you apply a drug. And that drug is going to stop the replication of these guys, so there might be sort of this initial decline. But if a mutation exists or a mutation arises, which can't be blocked by the application of that drug, that one will come over and take over. So you're driving the sequence of HIV both from HLA and from the drugs that you're giving. And so here's this cartoon again of this HIV life cycle. And we have all of these different parts of HIV that are involved in different parts of its life cycle. And so when you're giving lots and lots of different drugs to somebody that are targeting different parts of the life cycle of HIV, effectively you're requiring HIV to mutate many parts of its genome at once. So even though, you know, we know there's this very high mutation rate of 1 in 10,000, 1 in 10,000 seems like a small number when you're producing a billion viruses, right? Because you expect every position to mutate every day. But when there's three positions that mutate, it's 1 over 10,000 cubed. And when you need four positions to mutate all at once in order to escape, it's 1 over 10,000 to the fourth, which is a huge number. Huh? So when we think about emergence of resistance, we need to think about two elements that HIV has to overcome. One is a genetic barrier, and one is residual replication. So the genetic barrier is the selective pressure. So how many different positions HIV needs to mutate in order to escape the pressure of the drug. Residual replication is how effective it is at stopping HIV from copying itself. So you might give a drug that slows down the copy rate by 1%, but requires mutation in 50 different places to escape. So that's not going to be very effective because you've done almost nothing. But you could also give a drug that, you know, is 99% effective in slowing the copying process, but only requires one mutation. So that's genetic barrier and residual replication. And different drugs vary in both of these aspects. If you only need one nucleotide change, you have a low genetic barrier. But if you need many mutations to accumulate, you have a high genetic barrier. So even after you've escaped, so we saw this in the HLA example, it's going to keep mutating to become fit. So first it mutates to get away, and then it mutates to become very fit. So one thing to keep in mind, though, is that the amount of drug that you give is also affects this sort of residual replication. But you can't just give a ton of a drug. You can't just pick something with a high genetic barrier and give a lot of it to prevent HIV from mutating, because you'll kill somebody. So, as a function of the concentration of the drug, you can ask about the probability of an adverse event, right? And so you want to have not give too much of something. So if you have drugs that require a lot of concentration in the body before you can make someone sick, you know, it's a good thing, right? So we're kind of, I want to leave a little bit of time. So, and this is what was covered at the last, but, you know, just to review, if we, you know, we have this genotype test that can look at the sequence variants of HIV within an individual. You know, this was covered really well, so I'm just going to skip over it. And just come back so we can think about it now just in the context of these variants. So here was this conserved sequence of HIV, and here were these different treatments, and here are all these treatments, again, these different mutations that we observe that confer resistance. But you know, one thing that hasn't been thought of that much, which is an area of active research, is to not just think about when you're choosing which drug to prescribe next, people might want to start thinking about the sequence of the individual as well as the sequence of the drug. So, for example, if this individual is on this medication and you observe this mutation and now you're choosing from this list of other drugs to give, you want to pick one that's not also resisted by here, so you have sort of these choices. But if you know that this mutation here, right, is unlikely to happen with a particular HLA type, you might choose to give this drug because this drug will combine very well with an individual's immune system. So these are some of the older drugs that had a lower genetic barrier to resistance that only required one mutation, and these are some of the more modern treatments now that require lots and lots of mutations. But by giving all of them at once, you're requiring HIV to mutate in all of these different positions in order for it to escape. So this is a summary of the way that HIV escapes from the drugs. It's very similar to the way HIV is escaping from the immune system. You have this high virus turnover. You have this error-prone reverse transcription that results in lots of mutations of HIV. And then you have drug pressure. You end up with a drug-resistant virus, and that might cause decreased viral fitness and a decreased phenotypic susceptibility, but HIV will then continue to mutate and become efficient again. So one person had asked in the last lecture about transmission. So HIV drug resistance, if it's acquired in one individual, then all of the sequences in that individual will be resistant. So if they pass that sequence, if they give it to somebody else, then that individual will have acquired resistance. And that's why it's important to genotype early, as soon as they're diagnosed. So the mutation, because it's not as fit as it was in the presence of the drug, will often mutate away. But it will stay dormant. One copy of it will often stay within the host. And so if you look at someone who had a particular mutation of drug resistance, you keep going back and sequencing them, even after 2 years, only 18% reverted back to wild type. So here's some results from a 2000 survey of newly diagnosed HIV individuals. And this is sort of getting at the question that was asked earlier. So 16% in 2007, 16% of newly diagnosed HIV patients had a mutation that conferred resistance to these different drug treatments. And so, you know, these were some of the early drugs, but basically population, or the U.S. population, has mutated all of the HIV within the U.S. to be, you know, resistant at a very high frequency to these class of drugs. So, you know, 20% of the people who get a new HIV infection are already resistant to some of these older therapies. And I'm just going to conclude with one last effect of pharmacogenomics. So we talked about how human variation affects HIV risk and susceptibility, and we talked about how HIV variation confers, you know, protection from different drugs. This is one example of how human variation affects adverse side effects to an HIV drug. So there's this HLA allele. Remember, this is one of the alleles that was conferring protection from HIV, and I told you it came up a lot in these adverse drug studies. So there's this HIV medication, Abacavir, and some people are hypersensitive to it as a function of their genotype at that gene. So if you are negative, you have a very low to no likelihood of having this hypersensitivity. But if you're positive, 48% of the time, you will be hypersensitive, and so the prescription is to avoid that drug. So when screening's not available, it's okay to give, or that's the recommendation. And the reason is because that allele occurs very rarely. So only 5% of the population is a carrier in Europe, and 1% in Asia, and less than 1% in Africa. As a summary to this section, HIV genotyping is a snapshot in time. It's not a complete catalog of the resistant mutations that exist. It's only the most common sequences in an individual. The medications at the time of the genotype are very helpful to understand the mutations that are detected, so you can kind of put everything on this map. And it's really important to review the history, because even though a sequence might have not come up as conferring resistance, if you know somebody was on a treatment earlier, it's very likely that they still contain a sequence that's resistant to previously given therapy. The last point was just that the response to pharmaceuticals is a function of both the host genome and the HIV genome. All right. Thanks for your time. Anybody have questions?